This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Meera Sivasuthi. It is our health and living segment, and at the World Economic Forum in Davos earlier this year, the CCAN 2025 City Cancer Challenge was launched. We're going to find out what that's all about from the CEO of the Union for International Cancer Control. We'll also learn more about the World Cancer Congress that's going to be held right here in Malaysia in the year 2018. We'll be hosting that for the first time ever. Welcome to the show. I have with me the Union for International Cancer Control CEO, Kerry Adams. How are you today, Kerry?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Kerry, you were at the World Economic Forum in Davos earlier this year. I mean, how did this whole City Cancer Challenge come about, and what was that experience like being in Davos, bringing this initiative to that stage?
Well, I guess the idea of mobilising cities around the world to improve cancer treatment and care probably started about 18 months beforehand, when the UICC, my own board, and our partners were in discussion about how we take the next steps to improve cancer treatment and care around the world, given that we had a number of major wins on the global level. So, for example, the World Health Assembly, we'd had a number of targets for the non-communicable diseases, including cancer, on reducing premature deaths by 25% by 2025, targets for tobacco control. We also had a global action plan that had been agreed by the World Health Assembly, and we were pretty confident that we were going to see the Sustainable Development Goals include cancer and the other NCDs. So the challenge was, how do we mobilise all this great work? How do we get these global commitments where every country around the world has signed up to them and say, well, let's make it happen now. Okay, the talking is over. We've had 7 years of a lot of UN meetings discussing these sort of things. How do we make it happen? And the discussion turned towards, do we continue to work with cities around national cancer control planning, improving cancer registries, or should we augment that in some way? And the idea of a coalition of international partners working with cities around the world, where you have very defined populations, we chose a population of 1 million and above as being a starter point, could we actually reach out to those populations and help them with the international expertise that's available? And the initial feedback from countries and cities around the world was very favourable. Particularly, it was interesting when we spoke to the World Economic Forum and the World Bank and the World Health Organization, to be fair, there was a sense of ambition around it because it represented something where you could bring a truly multi-sectoral group together. Rather than being a civil society movement, it would become an international one. And our colleagues at the World Economic Forum basically said, we really like this initiative. We'd like to come in as a partner. And more importantly, we would love to launch it at Davos so that the global business community and the political elite that actually attend it at Davos can hear about the invaluable role that cities can play around the world in addressing health more broadly, but specifically investing in cancer treatment and care. So that's where the forum link came into Davos. And they also understood, as many of us do, that if you look at the world's population, we're moving fast past 50% of the world's population living in cities to, by 2050, being 66% of the world's population, which is a large chunk, over 6 billion people. So we have to recognize the fact that if we want to address global health in the future, then those are the places where you have to invest in people's health, risk factor prevention, avoidance of tobacco use, etc., but also investing in the fact that we will have, with an older population, more and more people having cancer.
Why the focus on cities, Kerry?
The cities themselves are self-governed environments. We've worked for many years at trying to enable countries to develop national cancer control plans. And after all the last 10 years of mobilizing enthusiasm around the world, about 36% of countries have what we would describe as well-written and funded and implemented national cancer control plans. And the idea emerged through a discussion on the weaknesses and strengths of pursuing that avenue, which we will continue to pursue because we do believe that the governments of every country should put cancer in the very much the center of their health plans, because this is where the growth is in all diseases. It's one of the largest killers in the world, so it has to be addressed. But how could we mobilize groups that could actually invest in cancer treatment and care themselves? And most cities have a fair amount of autonomy with regard to the income they can generate through taxation. They tend to have a health infrastructure in place already. They have a growing burden of cancer. They have a pool of individuals that can be trained up to become oncologists and nurses. They often have the basics in place, like the transport system, et cetera, et cetera. And unlike other non-communicable diseases, cancer really does need a fully equipped and expert cancer treatment center solution, or several of them, in order to address the population. You can't spread it around the country. You can't have several cancer treatment centers in rural areas, for example. You have to have a central solution. So the idea that cities could take a lead in creating an infrastructure of cancer treatment centers around the world that could potentially talk to each other, exchange best practice, was discussed, tested, and many people came back. And the result so far is that cities do see that they can play a fundamental role in treatment of cancer globally. Now, it might be worth just noting that you can look at addressing cancer globally, where you've got 14 million new cases every year, 9 million deaths nearly, as being a bit overwhelming. But if you break it down into cities of population over 1 million as a start point for the next 10 years' focus, then you're looking at 520 cities. And in low and middle-income countries, you're looking at no more than 300. So that's not beyond the realms of possibility that over 10, 15-year period that we could mobilize potentially those cities to recognize where they are in terms of the quality of the treatment and care they're providing for cancer patients and to lift that up as we aim towards that 2025 date, which is so important in the United Nations health calendar.
And where does Kuala Lumpur fit into the frame? I mean, were we part of this in Davos?
No, Kuala Lumpur.
Or after Davos?
Kuala Lumpur will be involved at some point. With a population above 1 million, we would love Kuala Lumpur to sign up to commit to addressing cancer in a better way than it does today. And everyone has gaps, so it's not picking on Kuala Lumpur. If I went to London or Washington, everyone has gaps in the way that they treat cancer within their own boundaries. At the moment, we have launched in Davos, and our ambition in the first 2 years was to set up a series of learning cities. And the reason we have adopted the word learning cities rather than pilots or demonstration sites is because we recognize that this is a first of its kind. Cities have not signed up to doing this before. We have not brought together an international consortium as we have today. So that consortium includes 22 pharmaceutical companies. It includes the three significant radiotherapy producing companies in the world, Varian, Elekta, and Accuray. It includes all of the major international professional associations for oncology and nursing, pathology, medical oncology, radio oncology. It includes hospital builders that are experts in building treatment centers. It includes the World Economic Forum, the World Bank. So already you're looking at a group of organizations which haven't worked together in this way before. So this is to some extent an experiment, but we believe it will be successful. So the ambition in the first 2 years is to work with five learning cities so we can learn the process of how we work with the local population, the local expertise, the local government, and the national and the city governments to evaluate where that city is and to then put out a plan and a funding plan as well with the help of international players to improve the treatment and care available to that population. Now, an outcome of that work will be that we will probably by the end of this year have what we've called at the moment a self-evaluation toolkit, which means that, yes, we will go with the five learning cities over 2 years to help them through that process. But we will also produce a self-evaluation toolkit. So in any city around the world, willing and able with its local population to do a self-evaluation and then to see where they are against what a baseline of services looks like, and then they can set out their own plans and they can set out their own way they're going to fund that, working with the international community. And we expect probably a lot of cities in the developed world to actually do that because they have the capacity themselves to do the evaluation and then to evaluate. But my ambition is quite large. I would like all cities over 1 million by 2025 to have signed up to the challenge, publicly signed up to the challenge, so that we can measure progress that our generation is putting in place to protect the generations of our children and our children's children.
How are we benchmarking this challenge against?
Benchmarking is in sort of three levels. Okay, so the first level is we've worked with colleagues around the world in WHO, National Cancer Institute in America, and others who are experts in the field in terms of cancer treatment and care. And we've produced a document which we released in Davos, which says this is the baseline services that a city should really be providing. It covers the most common cancers. That was drawn from work that's been done with the World Health Organization over at least 2 years, which has built up the list of what they call the essential medicines. These are the essential cancer medicines that every country should have. And a new list, which is emerging, which is called the essential technologies list. And so what technology should a cancer treatment center have to provide the baseline service to everyone? So that's a great asset, because it means that we're able, when we're doing the evaluations of cities, we can compare and contrast them against a baseline. Now, that baseline does not cover all cancers. It does not cover all the drugs that are available in the world. In fact, it very much is focused on the essential medicines, most of which are generics, rather than the new personalized medicines, which are very expensive. But with that baseline in place, what it does is it gives platform for each country over time, each city over time, to build on that, because you cannot take on a new drug, for example, if you do not have pathology, if you do not have diagnostics. And one of the major inhibitants, actually, for good treatment and care is the ability to do good pathology and diagnostics, so you know what cancer the individual has and what stage it is at, and therefore what is the appropriate treatment. So we'll be over time be able to see where cities are against that baseline, and that will be reported through our system. Second level is that in addition to that baseline achievement, we would also like to see the number of patients that are treated. We can measure that because each city will provide that data to us. And also, hopefully, over time, we will be able to monitor that the stage at which a person is presented to a treatment center. I'm not too sure whether all your listeners are familiar with stage, but there are essentially four stages yes. to cancer. Mm-hmm. So if we're looking at, say, for example, the King Hussein Cancer Center in Jordan, when it was first built and it was delivering services to Amman and Jordan, probably about two-thirds of all women who went into that treatment center were presenting at stage 3 and 4. And breast cancer at stage 3 and 4 is extremely difficult to treat. It can be treated successfully, but it's more difficult. Now, because of an education program they've rolled out across the city and the country, you're finding that two-thirds of women who present with breast cancer are presenting in stage 1 and 2. So the success rate, the cure rate, goes up enormously, which engenders support and enthusiasm from the community to support and help that particular cancer center. So we'll be able to measure those sort of things in time to show that there's progress, not in terms of just delivering a baseline, but also delivering improvements in treatment and care to that population.
Fantastic. We're discussing the City Cancer Challenge, which was launched at the World Economic Forum earlier this year in Davos. The Union for International Cancer Control is taking the lead in this, am I correct? And we have the CEO, Carrie Adams, in the studio with us. I think when we come back, I want to find out a little bit more about whether or not we have a baseline for Kuala Lumpur already, as well as, you know, you spoke about how a lot of these sectors involved in cancer have yet to come together in the past. Pharmaceutical companies, oncologists, WF, the World Bank, and all of that. And in my mind, I'm just thinking, right, why haven't we come together already when we have had a whole load of other issues, health issues to deal with? That framework, ideally, in my mind, should have been there already for you to just come in and tap on for cancer. But that doesn't seem to be the case. We'll come back and just get your thoughts on that. If you have a question for Carrie, our phone lines are open. It's 0377 109 000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 0162 019 000. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodhi. It's our Health and Living segment, and in the studio with me, CEO of the Union for International Cancer Control, Carrie Adams. We're discussing cancer in the city. At the World Economic Forum earlier this year, something called the CCAN 2025, which is a city cancer challenge, was launched, whereby cities in the world have been encouraged to come on board with the Union for International Cancer Control and, you know, come up with a plan to tackle cancer from a city perspective, with them taking the lead. Of course, Kuala Lumpur being one of them. Do we know where we stand, Kerry, in terms of baseline and what you were discussing just now about identifying the common cancers first and then the medicines and the technology and, you know, patient measurements and all of that? I am convinced that Malaysia has a pretty good healthcare system in place. What are your thoughts on that? And is our baseline higher than most other countries?
Well, I could name a lot of other countries that have got no oncologists or one pathologist and things like that. And you're certainly not in that group whatsoever. But that doesn't mean there isn't room for improvement. With regard to Kuala Lumpur or Malaysia, with regard to baseline, that work has not been done yet. That would be an evaluation that could take place next year once the tool's been done. But I would suspect that any evaluation of any city or country would lead to a plan to improve certain areas. We sort of group cities into three types. There's those that are, you know, if I take Boston, for example, if they looked at where they are, they would have problems. They would have issues. If you take Washington, for example, the 11 streets down from the White House, you've got populations where the deaths, the mortality through breast and cervical cancer is as high as many parts of Africa because, you know, the social economic groupings and the inavailability of insurance and coverage, etc. So cities have their own issues and problems, and many of the cities will evaluate, we hope, and they will set in plan their own actions, possibly not drawing on the international community. Then there's probably a whole group of cities where they will have specific areas where they need competence. They need training, they need support from the international community. For example, in pathology. Pathology is a common theme that's emerging from most cities. They haven't got the expertise who are trained up to actually do it. And there are remote ways that we could do that now, maybe, you know, not necessarily putting in more people, but putting in some people and links to international communities around the world to do remote pathology. And then there will be, in low-income countries, some cities where there's a lot of hand-holding help. It's, you know, they really are starting at a very low base where they probably haven't got radiotherapy machines, or they've got few and little expertise to actually implement them. And you need all of that, surgery, radiotherapy, and chemotherapy, to be successful in the treatment and care of individuals. So I think we'll get a mix over time, and I would probably say that at the moment, my understanding of where we are with Kuala Lumpur, probably in the middle, certainly not the bottom and not at the top.
Are urbanites more susceptible to particular types of cancers? And is that also something you're going to be looking at?
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons why the urban environment was an attractive way to look at how we could address cancer in the future. If you imagine a world where 520 cities are working together to address cancer treatment and care, but also addressing risk factors, that's a very powerful proposition for future years. There's enough evidence to suggest that as urban environments increase their population, the population adopts more risk factors which are linked to cancer. So the tobacco use, obesity, lack of physical activity. You've also got diet changing. You know, even go around Kuala Lumpur, seeing the various food outlets that clearly have come from the USA. You've got that sort of thing, but also you've got the environment itself in terms of air pollution, etc. So there was a recent study in America from Harvard which suggests that now if you lived in the country generally, and this is globally, you have a 17% less chance of developing cancer over time. So there's enough evidence growing that, you know, a city environment, if it's not managed well, if the government is not aware of the healthy design parameters it should be putting in place, cycle paths, use of tramways, though, making nice green areas where people can run and jog, you know, no smoking in any building. These things have to be built in order for a city to be, you know, a place to live which is safe and can certainly perpetuate longer life, but at the same time it's not a place where we're embedding NCDs, non-communicable diseases, and cancer in the future. So there's an opportunity there as well.
Okay, it just sounds that something that we're always talking about, you know, that we lack the space, we lack the facilities to do all of this. And just not for cancer, as you said, it's for our general health. Mm. So how will you get cities to get going? What will be the motivation to get, you know, governments on board? Governments on board for them to buy in and actually do something about this?
Yeah.
Because it goes beyond cancer.
It does. It does go beyond cancer because there is an obligation on city leaders from an environment perspective as well as from a health perspective. But the two are quite closely linked. Perhaps I can explain some of the work that we've done with regard to designing the City Cancer Challenge has been to look out at city initiatives around the world and see how they operate and how they can be successful and how they have overcome some of the barriers or the concerns which you've just expressed. So one of the organizations that we've been talking to is an organization called C40 Cities, and they're based in London. And they have, I think, 85, 84 cities that are part of their community And they work on the environmental issues. Okay, that's what they're doing. They're trying to make green cities, cities which do not impact CO2 emissions over time. They've been running, I think, for about 10 years, and they were originally funded by Bloomberg. They're now a team, I think, of 140 people, and they work with those cities around the world to encourage them to adopt green policies. And many of the policies they adopt then have a health impact because it's improving the air quality, for example. They've been very successful, and they have set up what they call communities across all of the cities. And what they found is, certainly they started off as a top-down model where they would bring experts and give advice and things like that. And they found that now all the good ideas which are being generated are being generated and shared by the cities themselves, because the cities not understand specifically the challenges they're facing, but they also understand what the financial implications are. So, for example, if you adopt a tram system around a city, it's expensive. The capital investment is there. But what the cities do is those who have adopted and have made the case and have found the funding model in order to put trams in place share all that good, those good ideas and best practice with cities that wish to adopt. We suspect that as we grow our base of cities around the world, what we will see is cities helping cities, and we will be encouraging that so that they will understand the barriers that they face and they can help overcome them. And we'll draw out best practice and share that through a regional forum or maybe a congress every so often so that the cities are solving their own problems. And that's a general principle which I think is quite critical in these city initiatives. The successful ones give ownership of the issue and the problem to the city, and then provide the expertise and the resources to do it. Let me just about one factor, which is absolutely critical. How do we fund it? Okay, health infrastructure in a country and also a city can be perceived to be expensive, and cancer specifically can be seen or viewed as an expensive disease to treat. So one of the publications that we issued when we were at Davos was a new document looking at what the options are for cities to raise the funds to pay for the initial capital outlay on a cancer treatment center, which can be anywhere between $15 and $45 million to set in place, either as part of a current hospital or as a standalone. And then the ongoing costs of delivering services on that baseline that I described earlier, around about $30 million, $40 million a year. Depends on the number of patients, obviously, going through that system. So that gives you like a headline number, which a government, both the federal government, national government, and the city need to consider if they wish to invest in addressing cancer in their population. The return on that investment is enormous. Over time, there will be a return. We've already done work with Lancet in the last couple of years looking at just the return on investment in radiotherapy, which is the largest chunk of the capital investment, you know, is enormous. Over a 10-15 year period, you are saving enough people's lives, you are contributing to the economic growth, you are stopping people losing all their funds and their wealth, you are reducing the burden on other parts of the system. So there's enough evidence out there that suggests that this is a really good investment. But the question is, how do governments get the initial capital investment to put it in place? Mm-hmm. Because it can be perceived to be very large.
Yeah, and there's no solution to that.
There are lots of solutions to that. I mean, this document outlines a number of ways in which that can be done. For example, the use of a municipal bond, the use of sin taxing on tobacco, which some countries deploy. It could be through bilateral funding, where particularly in low-income countries, where they can draw on overseas development assistance to put in place. The ongoing costs still have to be paid through an insurance scheme or through philanthropy or through private sector investment. There are many models out there. Again, it goes back to the point I said earlier, that one of our roles is to give cities the opportunity to look at and understand case studies on how it's been solved before, not necessarily in cancer, but in other health issues. And so that can inspire them at least to overcome some of those barriers, those misconceptions about it is too expensive to deal with cancer. Yeah. There are ways around it.
This is just me coming from the layperson on the ground, from what I've watched over the last many years. Initiatives like these are made on a very high level, World Economic Forum, you know, that sort of level, the World Bank, WHO and all of that. So If I were to take COP21, for an example, our commitments to reduce the carbon emissions and to manage global rise in temperatures of 2 degrees by a certain year. Now, that came from Paris, you know, governments meet. It's all happening on a very high level. And I'm sitting on the ground and watching all of this. Yes, I will ratify this convention and all of that. But somehow it just feels like it's not trickling to the ground. It doesn't seem to be getting to the people who need the help. So with COP21, yes, we will help you reduce carbon emissions through transfer of technology and all of that. It's going to cost us a lot of money as well. So all of this has to be done on an environmental level, on a health level. How do we manage that? And for developing countries, let's not even go to third world countries, it's costly. And the understanding on this side of the world is that the West is benefiting from all of this in terms of technology transfer. You get paid for it. In terms of expertise and know-how, it's coming from there and it's costing us a lot of money. So is there a way in which we can see this benefiting people on the ground faster than just high-level talks at this stage?
Just a couple of points on that. Before I got into the global health field, I was in the private sector.
Yes, I was about to ask you. Yeah, in banking in particular.
In banking, yes, absolutely. Yeah. I ran banks, a number of banks, a portfolio of banks around the world. So I would say that the month before I joined this job, I was very cynical about the UN system. I didn't really understand it. And I'd seen loads of declarations and things like that. And I wasn't too sure what value it brought. Having spent 7.5 years in this space, I have absolute respect for the UN system and those high-level discussions that you talk about, because it is the global governance package that we have set out about to agree how we address global issues, and there's no other alternative. As dysfunctional as some people may declare the UN system or the World Health Organization or whatever it may be, it is the vehicle through which we secure global agreements to global problems. So that's that. We have to accept that. So I have to work in that system all the time, and I have a lot of appreciation for the fact that you need to get all countries signed up to a particular resolution. The work that civil society does, which is essentially where I sit now, another defined community of people, but in civil society, my role is to make sure that when those discussions take place at a global level, there are essentially three components to them. The first one is we get an incredibly strong resolution. And I would say that in the past, a lot of the resolutions or discussions have taken place because of the compromises around that resolution. They do come across and potentially lack the bite that are required to see things happen at a national level, because there will be, for example, the subtlety of the clauses in those resolutions will be a very clear statement of intent and then comma if appropriate. Well, that is a weak clause.
Absolutely.
An absolute weak clause. Mm-hmm. And my team and the people that I work with around the world are well versed in the wriggle room which those sort of things give you. So the ambition that we do is, one, we want a very strong resolution, and we would rather trade away a clause than have a weak one. We want things in there which are statements of intent, which then can be used by civil society around the world to follow up with those governments and say, you have committed to this. How can we help you do it? What is the next step? How do we do that? So that's the first thing. The second thing within each of those resolutions, we're looking for accountability. So we're looking for some sort of measurement process whereby a resolution is aligned with a reporting process. And the reporting process being they have to submit data so that it can be compared and contrast. And, you know, most governments, particularly leaders of most nations, do not like seeing themselves at the bottom of a table. They don't like that. So the data process needs to be embedded within the resolution. What are you going to report on? I guess in my old world, that would be the key performance indicators. Mm-hmm. But these are the things that need to be embedded. How do we measure and evaluate progress against that resolution? And the third component, which is absolutely critical, is when is it going to be reviewed? So you, if you look at, say, the NCD process, non-communicable disease process, we had the resolution in 2011. We then had all the targets agreed in 2012. We had an action plan agreed in 2013. We had the first review in 14, and there's another review in 18. So that's establishing in the mindset of all governments around the world that there is accountability, measurement, and there's going to be reviews. And this is a strong part of the UN system. So I think that's an important thing to remember. The second thing is that what happens at national level is, yes, you may have a government will go to those particular meetings and they'll sign up to something, but it's absolutely critical that they are held to account by their own population. And that's where the role of civil society is. And we don't do that in an angry way. I'm not a great believer in outrage and chaining people to fences and things like that and placards. What I'm interested in is the community which I work in, which is the health community, then use that as a bridge into the government and say, these commitments have been made. How do we work with you to make them happen locally? What are those barriers, et cetera, et cetera? And probably the City Council Challenge represents a really good example of how we can mobilize local people to follow through on commitments that we've made at a UN level. So I think we have to work with the tool set that we have. I think there are ways that civil society can work with it in a more effective way. Now, with regards to the question about how do, you know, developing countries or low middle income countries respond to that, I think there's also an onus on the international community to help people respond through the expertise they can provide, the resources they can provide, and not by just sales of products. I think that the implication from your question is it's a way of selling more products around the world. And it's certainly, I don't look at it. I listen to a lot of the things that are said by the health corporate community, and I'm getting a growing sense of them understanding that there's a moral obligation to fulfill these commitments to low and middle income countries, and it's not just a profiteering motivation. That's my sense of talking to people and certainly listening to CEOs at Davos. So we need to work with low and middle income countries because they're at such a low baseline that they need the help of the international community. I think where we've done well, and probably the best one to hold up as a model of this is, for example, HIV, AIDS, malaria, and TB. If you look at how the international community came around those particular diseases at the turn of the century and the results that we now see on that, I think we should be very proud that there's been such significant achievements in reducing the numbers or certainly managing the numbers in that space. And I would also argue, if you looked at the Millennium Development Goals and where the successes have been, the real successes have been on maternal health and child health. Extraordinary achievements on the health side of the MDGs. So with the Sustainable Development Goals having SDG 3 on health, evidence that it does work, evidence we are focusing overseas development assistance on the key areas as agreed at the UN system, and a robust process of follow-up through civil society, I am more positive that this will lead to the trickle-down and that you will see action emerging in the next 5 to 10 years across all countries, putting cancer and the NCDs as a major part of their health challenge.
Fantastic. We have Kerry Adams, CEO of the Union for International Cancer Control, in the studio with us, finding out a little bit more about something called the CCAN 2025 City Cancer Challenge, which Kuala Lumpur is going to be a part of, setting up baseline initiatives to take cancer treatments, prevention, everything up to the next level. Of course, when I come back, I want to find out what would be the ultimate outcome of this in 2025. What are we going to aim towards? That's coming up next. If you have a question for Kerry, give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp us on 016-201-9000. Good afternoon, and if you have just joined us, welcome. It is The Bigger Picture, and I'm Mira Sevasothi. In our health segment today, we have the honour of having Kerry Adams, CEO of the Union for International Cancer Control, in the studio with us, helping us to shed more light on the City Cancer Challenge, which was launched at the World Economic Forum in Davos earlier this year. It's called CCAN 2025. And, I'm just throwing some of the questions at him, in that we've signed, as I said, a million conventions and, commit to it. So many things on a global level, right from health to the environment and everything else. Where does this come in as far as the pecking order is concerned? So before I come back to my questions, we have Kalai on the line. Hi, Kalai.
Hi.
Hi, you have a question. Go ahead.
Yeah. particular question is how the patients can communicate to the support system. What is the mode of communication? Because normally when the patient, they are diagnosed, right? Because I'm one of them.
Okay.
So when I was diagnosed, I really panicked. And I was like lost. And I needed a lot of support at that moment. But I do not know who to call, how to call. Even there is a lot of NGOs and so on. When I tried to contact them, I didn't really get the kind of answers that I wanted, especially for my questions. And when I asked them, where should I start? When I was told that I'm at stage 2, it was a total blank for me. I went into isolation for 3 weeks, and then I contacted some centers in the US.
Sure.
Skype. Yeah, that's how I got.
I just wanted to know, did you contact the National Cancer Society of Malaysia by any chance?
I only know it today. I only know Magda. I contacted Magda.
Okay, all right.
But,
okay.
Yeah.
Sure. All right, thank you very much, Kalai. Well, the National Cancer Society of Malaysia is an organisation Carrie is actually working very closely with. Am I correct, Carrie?
Yeah, that's right. We're running the World Cancer Congress in Kuala Lumpur next year. Mm-hmm. So, which you mentioned at the beginning of the show. And they are our partner, and we're working with the local government as well in making sure that when 3,500, 4,000 people turn up, that they have a tremendous congress here in October 2018.
Okay. Support is what part of that, the whole plan, Kerry?
It is, yeah. In fact, within the congress, we run a whole track, which is about supporting the patient. And a lot of my members around the world are patient groups, probably about 400 or so out of the 1,000 that we have. Mm. And listening to the caller, this is not an unusual situation. I mean, when faced with a cancer diagnosis, it can be very difficult for individuals to find their pathway through the health system, but also to reach out and find organizations that can help. And I know that the organizations here, you've mentioned them, are extremely strong. And I would hope that eventually in those first couple of weeks, when someone is looking for support and advice, they would be able to find a patient-focused organization which has experience of dealing with patients through that first initial step and answering those questions which everyone would have, including the family members. It's not just the patient themselves. But there's certainly ways in which that can be improved. But yes, I would hope that in most circumstances they would be able to find someone who better help them.
What took us so long, Kerry? Why haven't we worked together before?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I mentioned at the beginning the coalition that we pulled together. And I must say that one of the most rewarding part of pulling this together was the fact that we were able to talk to organizations that haven't talked to each other before. Cancer is a series of segmented treatment offers which are pulled together within a hospital or a treatment center, but the pharmaceutical industry would very rarely talk to the radiotherapy industry. I mean, why should they?
Mm-hmm.
Why would GE and Philips, who produce most of the imaging technology, why would they be talking to, for example, the palliative care people? I mean, it represents a health system which to some extent is quite fragmented. But when we approached those industries, we said that we didn't want to work with individual companies. We wanted the industries to support this initiative. And this was a first for them. It's the first time they've been approached. Now, you could say, should we have done this before? But I don't think we had the global framework to provide a very clear reason for us to work together. So that is the targets, the 25% reduction in premature deaths by 2025, the action plan, the call for multi-sectoral support to do something. So this is a first manifestation of a call to action which came from that UN system. And in our initial discussions with the pharma industry, there's some of the issues and challenges of the pharma industry are well rehearsed. But to get them to come together and talk about cancer specifically was quite unique. So we managed to get, working with their affiliated organisations, for them to say they would support cancer. But more broadly, which I was really impressed with, 22 companies came together to form what they call Access Accelerated, which is the first time they've done that, addressing the availability of NCD drugs, non-communicable disease drugs, in low and middle income countries. And that also was launched at Davos. So I'm hopeful that what you've seen in the last 12 to 18 months of all the international work that's been done at a UN level is a series of announcements of coalitions where we are going to put together, to some extent, put aside the competitive aspects to address the core problems that we face around the world. So I'm reasonably optimistic in that space.
Cost is a big issue. You would agree with me, Kerry, when it comes to any sort of framework for health. So my question is, and coming from the banking sector and all of that, the Trans-Pacific Partnership has been thrown out the window at the moment. But if it does in fact come into play at any stage, how will something like the TPP affect your initiative?
Well, you're asking someone who's not overly familiar with the TPP, so I don't know how that would impact specifically country by country. I can't comment on that. Do I think that the world closing down on global trade and becoming more insular and national is good for global health? No, I don't think it is. I think that, as you said earlier, we are making great progress in our understanding of the disease, cancer specifically. We are making great progress in drug development. We are making great progress in technology development to spot it early, to understand what it is, and then to treat it. Now, that is naturally taking place in the wealthier parts of the world. And the transition of that discovery, the movement of patented drugs into generics, the availability of cheaper versions of the technology is absolutely critical if we're to address cancer globally. 70% of the growth in cancer incidence in the next 20, 25 years will be in low and middle income countries. It will not be in America or in Europe. It will be in low and middle income countries. So as a community, as a global community, if we wish to address cancer and the other NCDs, we have to do transfer of knowledge, understanding, and capability into countries who, at the moment, are not in a position to afford it, but that needs to be done through innovative financing or the delivery of cheaper technology, which is as efficient, but is designed specifically to meet the requirements of those countries.
How much say would you have in something like that?
How much?
Yeah.
I mean, there'd be billions of dollars.
How much of a say would you have as the Union for International Cancer Control?
Well, we do have a say because we're constantly involved in discussions with the World Economic Forum, the World Bank, and also the technology companies. And I don't know what influence we have at the end of the day compared to shareholders and others, but I do sense over the last 7 years in my conversations with certain organizations that have a critical role in the development of technology, for example, that they are becoming increasingly conscious of the importance of developing a strategy to address low middle income countries. And that's the pharmaceutical industry as well as the radiotherapy industry and diagnostics. So there has been a tone change in those conversations. I wouldn't put my hand down and say it was down through to the UICC, but I think the general discussions that have taken place at a global level, the understanding of the burden, the growth, the information that's been available, the commitments that have been made, the challenges from low and middle income countries to those companies saying that we cannot afford what you're offering us, I think that will lead in the next 5 to 10 years with a paradigm shift in the way it's done.
And we have so many NCDs to worry about. I mean, heart disease, cardiovascular disease is the number one killer in the world. In the UK, depression is expected to be the leading cause of death not so very long from now. So then where do we commit and where do we put our money, really? All of it's going to cost us.
Well, I think that the NCD, if we group them as non-communicable diseases, they have common risk factors. So the logic would dictate that you'd focus your attention on those risk factors. And the risk factors, tobacco, physical inactivity, alcohol, diet, if you address those, if you reduce the amount of smoking in the world, it's one third of cancers are caused of smoking, 80% of lung cancers. You know, it's a cause of six of the eight largest NCDs by volume, by number. I mean, that's the space where we can all work, and that's a common area. So any government that's looking to address NCDs in the future is going to be very, very hard with regard to, for example, tobacco control and implementing tax increases and banning tobacco use, et cetera, et cetera. So did I hear what you were saying about the markets? Was it being driven by BAT growth?
Yes,
how,
absolutely.
How ironic. Like,
yes,
I'm sitting here and you're... thank God for BAT, you know. You know, they kill 6 million people a year deliberately as an industry, and we're pleased that the market's gone up with BAT. Excellent. Anyway, but so that's one common area. With regard to the where do we spend our money with regard to, you know, heart disease, lung disease and everything else, that really has to be determined by government. They need to look at the profile of disease they have, the projections they have, and ultimately they have to make a decision on where they're going to spend their health budget.
You know, it's very simple, Kerry, when you talk about it. It's just political will. It's that simple.
It is. But there again, I'm probably, you know, if you've got someone from the environment sitting here, they'd say it's very simple. It's just political will.
But the
truth is that the politicians that I've met, it's not that they don't want to do something. It's that they're the same as everyone. They're constrained with regard to budget and the support they have around certain things. And that's where the likes of yourself and myself, our role is to make sure that they recognise what our priorities are, and that can be factored in. And that means good information. It means a way forward. It means finding solutions. It means helping, directing, steering, giving them the opportunity to be successful within the timelines they have. So we shouldn't underestimate the role that the ordinary person you described earlier has in helping politicians agree the priorities for their country.
So what are we hoping to achieve in 2025? Any sort of outcomes?
Well, 2025, there are some targets. I mean, there are global targets. So reduce premature deaths from NCDs by 25% by 2025. Reduce tobacco use by 30% by 2025. Reduce physical inactivity by 10%. And these will be measured by the WHO. So that's what we're hoping to achieve. Personally, on the City Cancer Challenge, I'd like to feel that we had at least 100 cities signed up and working with the international community to improve cancer treatment and care. And off the back of the 2018 Kuala Lumpur World Cancer Congress, I would hope that would generate enthusiasm and ideas and networks of support to help address cancer in the local community and the local region.
Fantastic. What would be your message, Kerry, from the UICC on cancer in the city?
Well, I would say that, no, we are at a point now where we have an awful lot of knowledge on how to avoid cancer, detect it early, even use vaccinations for human papillomavirus, and to treat it successfully if it's presented early. So I'm an optimist. If we can just put in place the things that we know, and we don't have to worry about new drugs coming out and personalized medicine, if we just put in place what we know today in the most efficient way, then we can increase the number of people who survive cancer.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for joining us today and for sharing your thoughts with us. That was Kerry Adams, CEO of the Union for International Cancer Control, talking to us about CCAN 2025 City Cancer Challenge, as well as, you know, the initiatives of the UICC in working with cities to help with this whole cancer initiatives worldwide. Thank you again for joining us. This is The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.